I've known Tony Fadell for a few years now, but I'll admit it. The first time I met him, I was pretty intimidated. I mean, the guy invented the freaking iPod and was part of the team that created the iPhone. In no uncertain terms, Tony's a giant. But I quickly learned that I had nothing to worry about. He's as humble and as approachable as he is brilliant and successful. He's also a diehard watch collector whose background in design, engineering, and business give him this really unique and thoughtful perspective on watches. And that goes from the tiniest individual details all the way up to the macro ebbs and flows of the industry at large. Talking for an hour with Tony and our editor-in-chief Jack Forrester is about the best horological masterclass I could ask for. I'm your host, Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Tudor. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at the Black Bay Bronze, a dive watch inspired by true naval engineering. You can also learn more at TudorWatch.com. Cool. Thanks so much for joining us, Tony. It's good to have you here.
Guys, Jack, Stephen, it's always good to see you.
Yeah, always good to see you too. I thought we'd kick things off actually by telling a story of the first time you and I met, which was at a Nest press conference back, I guess it would have been like 2015 maybe. You had already done your episode of Talking Watches. I knew you were a watch guy, but I was actually not at Hodinkee at the time. I was at Bloomberg.
I remember.
And I was reporting on Nest. I was doing personal tech coverage at the time. And I noticed when you were on stage that you were wearing a 5980 on your wrist. And I kind of made a little note and went and covered the press conference, did some video stuff with our team, and ended up coming in late to the interview that the other Bloomberg reporter had. And I kind of like snuck in and was like, oh shit, I'm late. And at the end, this guy, Brian, who I didn't know very well, threw the perfect question at you, which was, all right, Tony, I just got to ask, why aren't you wearing an Apple Watch? And I just couldn't help but laugh out loud. And I know I said something about the watch, and then you and I got talking, and I think your publicist had to kind of like shoo me out of the room because there were people waiting for more interviews. But is that a question you get a lot? I would imagine that's something people ask you.
You know what? Actually, almost no one asked me that question.
Really?
No one asked me that question.
About the Apple Watch in particular, about smartwatches in general, wearable tech in general?
Wearable tech, I get those questions, but about people will ask, well, have you looked at smartwatches and what do you think? Or comparing them, or what do you think about this one versus that? But no one's asked me what my personal preference is. They did it when the Apple Watch was first thing, and I was like, well, I don't know. I don't have one. I haven't tried one yet. They were still not available. Yeah. No one's really asked that question.
Interesting.
Have you given any of them a try since then? Have you really?
Oh, I have an Apple Watch. Absolutely. And so I have given that a try. I have the Matrix body heat watch. I probably have a collection of 20 to 30 different smart watches in different realms, just because I want to put my hands on, I want to feel, I want to see where the progression of the technology is going, understand how they're marketing it, what's the experience of unboxing and wearing and all that stuff. So it's more just to stay on top of things and to see where things are progressing.
What are your general thoughts about that market? I mean, I know you're obviously a mechanical watch guy, but sort of.
But we'll get into that, I'm sure. So what are my thoughts? My thoughts are, frankly, I want a watch that's stylish and functional and has the things that I really need on it. But I want a watch first and foremost. I'm not looking for another computer.
Okay, per se.
So we hear this a lot, you know, people who, you know, vocally object whenever we do smartwatch coverage. Yeah. And you know what you hear all the
time?
Which they do. And you know what we hear all the time is, well, it's not a watch. It's not a smartwatch. Smartwatch is not a watch. Can you kind of parse that for us?
Well, let's look at it in a different light. You know, the iPhone is called the iPhone, but most people don't use it as a phone. Now, you might say communications like some kind of iChat or something like that might be, you know, a phone, but most people don't use it as a phone if you look at the amount of time. So I think what we're doing is we are putting older terms on newer technologies to make it more relatable at the beginning, but that's not really how people use it. So we call it the Apple Watch, but people use it for much more than a timekeeping function.
Sure.
Right? And so we have to look at where it, what the marketing is versus where the product is and what it provides, and be able to properly segment that and look at it as its own merits, not necessarily competitive with mechanical watches, but it's in a different category. And yes, they tell the time, but it's one very small piece of the puzzle compared to all the other things it does. And some people want all those things. Other people want just simply the time or some complications, and that's all. And so to each his own, right? No issues with that.
And you're kind of, I mean, you mentioned it a minute ago, you're doing some work right now kind of at the intersection of technology and mechanical watchmaking. And I think some regular readers will remember the Resonance E-Crown that came out at SIHH, the concept watch. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and kind of maybe explain for people who don't know what we're talking about what that is?
Sure. So it's the Resonance E-Crown combined in the Type 2 concept watch.
Okay.
Right? And so what's it all about? So first and foremost, it's not about trying to create a smart watch, you know, in the category that we know of today, which is more a computer than it is watch.
Right.
This is really truly a watch with some functions in it to help tell the time better, right? That's really what it's about. It's not about adding other functions in it. It's just how do you make the time be told better or more accurately or simpler, you know, for the user, so they don't have to set it all the time.
So just to jump in and for clarification for people who aren't familiar with the project, the E-Crown watch is theoretically at least completely autonomous. It can and it's possible for it to function entirely as a mechanical watch independent of any connectivity.
Yeah. First and foremost, it's a 100% right. automatic mechanical watch. If you took the E-Crown out, and you can, it will work just like an automatic Type 1 watch from Resonance. So without a doubt, that's what it is. All it is the E-Crown is like a little robot we inserted inside to do the function that you normally do, which is to set the time, right? That's all the E-Crown really does, is just to set the time when the automatic watch loses its, you know, loses its ability to regulate time.
Yeah, one of the things you said when we first started talking about this back in January, I guess, was you likened it to the idea of a watch winder, which I thought was really interesting. And it's the idea of taking the winder and putting it inside the watch instead of having the watch sit inside the winder.
Good memory. Exactly. That's it. We have mechanical robots today. They're called watch winders to keep automatic watches functioning even when you're not wearing them. So what we decided was, and this was the idea of Benoit, not my idea, but his idea was, well, let's try to get rid of that need for a watch winder. Why isn't it always in the watch? But sure. Still keep it purely a mechanical watch. And so now from the external robot, we have the internal robot, not winding it, but setting the time.
It's really funny, though. I mean, that's to some people, I don't know how many, but to some people that actually feels like a transgression. You know, it's one we don't see an electronic watch winder as invalidating the fundamental sort of emotive integrity of a mechanical watch. But you put the little robot inside, and all of a sudden it's a little like for some
people.
It's
disconcerting to some, but you know, when I think about it, almost all of the things that I have been involved in my career have caused some people's hair on the back of their necks to stand up and go, oh, I hate it. And so if you get a reaction of I hate it or I love it, you already know you're on the right track. If you get some, like, people that just go, yeah, well, okay.
And some of those things have turned out to be, like, pretty big deals, right?
I think so.
You know,
That's up for you, right? Yeah. So look, at the end of the day, if you got a conversation and you got people who love it and people who hate it, I think you're on the right track, and we'll figure out over time, you know, people never want, they're like, I had to have a BlackBerry keyboard. If I don't have a BlackBerry keyboard, I can't use a phone, period. Well, that was what they were used to.
Right.
So just, you said, you know, some people, they're immediately enthusiastic about it, the early adopters, and some people it makes the hair stand up on the back of their heads. Is it the risk tolerant versus the risk averse? Is that how it breaks down?
No, I think it's I don't think it's risk. I don't think it's a risk thing. It's just a comfort thing, and it's something that is different from, it's change, you know, and some people just don't like change. They want to keep it. They have their idea of what the world looks like. And when that happens, they're like, oh, what's going on? But typically when people put it on, because, you know, a lot of people reacted and they didn't wear it. right? It's all about the experience. Right. And until you experience it, it's very different than what you read about or you see, right? You should put it on and then judge it for its merits when you have it and you've experienced it, not before and prejudging it. Just like we say, don't judge a book by its cover.
But what fun is that, actually learning about it before you pass judgment?
Oh, geez, come on, guys. Why not? Just pass judgment and, you know... That's what's great.
What were some of the best reactions you got, like either positive or negative? I mean, it must have been interesting being at SIHH, not as a collector, which we'll talk about in a bit, but being there sort of like in a booth, like representing a brand to an extent and getting feedback on a product that you were involved with.
Yeah, it's an honor to be at SIHH, right, with Benoit and the team, because that's really his show. It's not my show. Yeah, SIHH isn't my show. But to go there, it's kind of like the, you know... it's like the CES, right? In a way, much more highly refined. But
it's a lot more city.
Much better city.
Having been to both, it is much better than CES.
Exactly. And so when you think about it, you know, to be there and then to be a fly in the wall in all of these presentation meetings with, you know, with people such as yourselves who are kind of judging it. They got to wear it and try it and everything else. Yeah. It's great to hear the feedback and the questions and everything.
Tony, was that your first SIHH?
That was my second. That was my second. And so that was wonderful to see and to see from a connoisseur's eye or a real, you know, watch lover's eye what they're going to say. And I'll tell you, the reactions I got in email or on the floor is like, how fast can I get one? Can you get me on the list? I know these are limited. How fast can I get it? And then there were other people like, I'm not so sure. But most people didn't try it. They didn't see it. They didn't put it on the wrist. I didn't see any disdain for the people who looked at it, put it on. They were like, wow, this is light. And it does this. And they tried it. So, you know, I'm going to reserve judgment on all those other people who didn't try it yet. But at the end of the day, it will live or die based on its own merits. And I think there was enough positive response to say, yes, there is some sub-segment of the watch collector market who would like this. And maybe it can go beyond that when it becomes more easily accessible at other price points.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting way to look at it, right? Could this not only give watch enthusiasts a different way to look at what watchmaking is, but also give people who aren't interested in watchmaking a way to maybe get into watchmaking?
That's exactly the right way to think about it. It's about expanding the market, not just convincing those who are in the market, but expanding it. You know, if we look at the younger generations, and older generation for that matter, they want more convenience. Mm-hmm. And I know how many watch winders do you have? You know, and if you're a collector, you got to have a lot of watch winders. It takes up a lot of room.
Yeah.
You want all this stuff to work, but it's like, it's unbearable. And at some point you're like, oh, this might make it easy for collectors. But then it could also bring in a whole side of tech savvy people who say, wait a second, I'm going to experience a mechanical watch for the first time, but it's not going to have any of the issues that I thought it was going to have, which I'm going to have to wind it and set it. What's that all about? You know, today they have to charge them. They have to charge their devices, whether it's a watch or
a device. A traditionalist would say if you miss out on the experience of winding and setting your watch, you kind of miss out on, you know, 90% of the fun. You miss out on the relationship with the machine as a machine.
Well, and you could probably say that with people when we went from basically physical playing of music to recorded music, right?
Yeah.
You know, obviously the recorded music in the early days wasn't high quality. But today it's like the difference between MP3 and vinyl or what have you.
It's
you can go and talk about it that way. And yeah, there is going to be a certain aspect that might be different, but there might be benefits that come with it. And so we tried to make sure that you had the best of both worlds, a fully mechanical watch. You remove it in 100 years, you remove it, and it's still that amazing mechanical watch.
Right? Do you think this is something that has implications outside of resonance, that this is kind of a new approach or a new strategy that other watchmakers might adopt, maybe, you know, eventually bigger players, and that this could affect the market more broadly? Or do you think it's a relatively niche thing long term?
Long term, well, I hope it's successful. Right, and I hope it is adopted more readily by people and the industry. But I also see that this kind of same mentality is going on today in cars. We're adding robots inside of cars. They're called self-driving cars, right? Or we added them with, you know, warning crash warnings and, you know, helping to, you know, you know, stop crashes, automatic ABS, these kinds of things. Right. We added those things and people adopted them. And when they came down low enough price point over time, it's now mandated that it's there. Now that it's not going to happen in mechanical watches, of course, but it shows that there are new segments, there are new ways to bring people in to make things better. And I think that will happen in the watch area as well.
You know, that reminds me, a couple of years ago, I happened to have a car on a track, and the company that was hosting the event turned off, they put us on a skid pad and turned off all the, you know, all the electronic nannies, and it was absolutely terrifying. And in a million years, I would not want to ever go back to a situation where that stuff wasn't available.
Exactly. And so if you can experience the before and after, you start to go, wait a second, I appreciate it, I understand it now, and it's there for a really good reason. It's not just trying to break with tradition and be different for different sake. It's trying to make it better.
Well, if I could, was there a particular experience with a mechanical watch that you want to talk about, you know, in the concrete or even in a more, you know, sort of general abstract way that kind of drove you to come up with this? I mean, it's a pretty, you know, radical notion.
Well, I think that if you look at being a watch collector, at the end of the day, like I said, I think we'll get into this later, I'm much more about advanced technology watches. Okay, I want the latest and greatest, and I don't like to necessarily buy a watch that is just mechanically wound. I want something that's automatic. Ben and I have always had these arguments back and forth.
I bet.
And so, I appreciate the mechanically wound watches, hand wound, I have some. It's great, but I also appreciate the other side, and I'm not going to be a purist one way or the other. I think it's the same argument of should you have an e-crown or should you have just a pure automatic? It's the same argument between mechanical wound and automatic all over again, right? And so if I look at it, I say, okay, I want to have an automatic watch. I want the automatic to always be the right time so I can just put it on because my life is not about setting watches all day.
You have other things to worry about?
I have other things to worry about. And so some people find the delight in that piece of the puzzle. Great. But that's not what I want. I want it to be on my wrist and I want to go like this and I want to look down and it works. Right? And it's, you know, it's kinetic energy is charging it. I love that. Right? But the downside at the end of the day is I leave it on my desk side and you have multiple watches. You know, I'm sure the watch industry, everybody wants you to have multiple watches, not just one, right? So let's make it convenient for people to own more. And let's fix a fundamental problem with automatic watches. We could even probably do it with mechanically wound watches too, but I don't think maybe that's the right thing to do. But at the end of the day, I think that we should do it with automatic watches to take away the two things that are there.
That's
one is making mechanical like quartz without going to quartz, which is making sure it's always accurate. And two, making sure the time is always set correctly.
I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that because I have found this project technically interesting from the get-go. And I never actually saw it in the way you phrase it, which is as a natural extension of the greater convenience of a self-winding watch.
It's exactly
that's how you
that.
Look at it.
Yes,
yeah.
Remove the obstacles that are there. Make a more perfect watch. Not add lots of functions that are not watch oriented at all, which is a typical smartwatch.
Right.
So you mentioned that you like kind of like high tech, if I can put that in scare quotes.
In traditionalist sense of watch collecting.
Of course. Did you get a chance to walk around much at SIHH? And if so, what were some other things you saw that interest you?
Well, look, for me, kind of I love what Benoit and the team was able to create with what we were doing. But I have to hand it to, like, AP.
Yeah.
With the RD2.
Oh, man.
I salivated. I went crazy over the RD2. When I learned about how it was done and the technology they used to make that slim calendar watch, and to look at how it was done by the gearing that they've done and the teeth, it was basically a programmable mechanical machine. They created something like an automata from back in the day. That's what they created in there. And I can't believe when you see it, you go like, duh. But no one in the industry did that, and it was blow away.
Yeah.
So I was like, yes, baby, I'm in. And it doesn't have an e-crown or anything else, but I'm like, I appreciate that 100%.
I think my favorite,
I can't wait to have one.
I think my favorite thing about that watch is that they said they could have made it thinner, that there's actually extra airspace in the case, but they didn't because they thought it would destroy the proportion of the bezel to the case and it would mess up the actual design integrity of the Royal Oak. So instead of getting a record that they could use as marketing material, they actually focused on making the product the right product, which I feel so often gets lost, but they put making a good thing ahead of being able to sell some marketing collateral.
I had never heard that until you just told me, and I love it even more because a watch is about a watch or any design. It's not just about the internals and about going for specs. It's about the whole package, what it looks like, what it feels like, what the technology is inside it. The full representation that there was love and care thought about at every single point of the process. Totally. And to me, when you say it was bigger and there's a little bit more air, damn, okay, cool with me. Great, because it's going to wear differently. It's going to look different. Proportions are, for me, everything.
So what do you think of this? You know, in modern watchmaking, over the last, I would say, since about 2000, when silicon first started being used in mechanical watchmaking, you know, there's this increasing tension between watchmaking as a materials science activity and watchmaking as a traditional craft activity. Mm-hmm. So there's the sort of, you know, novelty versus tradition, you know, breakdown. But there's also a perceived dichotomy in some people's minds between pursuing watchmaking goals in the context of traditional crafts and pursuing watchmaking goals in the context of new materials and new technologies. You know, for close to 500 years, you had a few basic materials in watchmaking. You had brass, you had steel, and then whatever you were making the hands and dials out of. Jeweling was added in the 1700s, and that was about it.
Sure.
You know, for close to 500 years. And the departure from that is a relatively recent thing, and to some people it represents a kind of abandonment of the craft aspect of watchmaking that's of the most sort of fundamental interest to them.
Well, again, I think it's the same argument we talked about before of, you know, is a winder someone got used to or an automatic watch they got used to. It had to get over the hand-wound one, right? So when I think about it, we have titanium. We have carbon fiber. We have all kinds of other case materials. We have other types of materials inside the watch. We went from bearings to rubies to this, right?
It's, I mean, people, you know, in the 20th century had to get over wristwatches not being pocket watches.
Right, exactly. You know,
I mean, there was a huge segment of the watch buying public in the
1930s. We do often forget about that.
Yeah, there was a huge segment of the watch buying public in the 1930s who were like, are you kidding me? A watch on the wrist? What, are you stupid?
Or how about, what do you mean this watch, or what do you mean this clock is actually going to help me navigate the world? That's never going to work. You know, this is, again, this, you know, old world versus new world. You have to embrace, be curious, and have and understand that if you trust the people who are presenting it to you to a certain extent, have a little bit more of an open mind and learn and embrace. Because, you know, everything has to evolve. Yeah, the watch industry has to evolve. And there are lots of incredible technologies that need to be adopted. Now, I'm not saying all of them.
Right,
there's
right.
all kinds of issues with silicon, but they're starting to resolve those. Right, I have a couple based on that. So I think, again, that if we don't continue to move this forward, we're only going to have traditionalists buying them and the market will die.
Right.
And then we're all going to be sitting crying in our drinks going, why can't I get new watches? Because we're not feeding it the things that they need to be able to be economically healthy.
But don't you think there's something comforting? I mean, I'm not defending it, but there's something comforting from an enthusiast perspective about being inflexibly doctrinaire about things.
So that's their choice.
Yeah.
So be it. I have no judgment. That's fine. They should go off and do that. That's great. But industries must evolve to remain healthy, and we're not all going to just buy antique watches, you know, and right. stuff. We need to keep this place. We need to keep this industry healthy. We need new technologies to come in to keep people excited, the ones that are there excited, as well as new ones to come in. If we don't do that, it's going to be a dead end on the chain of evolution of watches.
And the RD2 is a perfect example of that. There's nothing overtly kind of like cutting edge about any of the material science, anything crazy like that. It's
yeah, as far
a new
as I
way
know, that's
of
true.
Thinking,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
And any traditionalist, if they see that watch, they have to embrace it. If they can't embrace the RD2, it's like, what? Come on. What? It's just different. And it's a lot better.
Right.
They didn't break all of the tenets of traditionalism in any way, shape, or form. They just did it incredibly smartly and amazingly that no one else had had taken that leap before, because it was in all kinds of industries, even in the 1800s.
Right. Right? Are there other watches you saw this year at SIHH or elsewhere that you think kind of represent that way of thinking about watchmaking?
Different. Well, I saw a lot of interesting materials, you know, new materials like the frosted gold or the whatever was the Bulgari, the gold version, because I have the other one, the titanium one, which I love. Right. But then the gold, I was like, wow, what's that?
It has such a soft look to it. It's really cool.
Incredible. But then I also look at the year before that, which was the frosted gold from who is that from?
You know,
from
AP.
AP. Yeah. I went on and instantly bought that for my mother, because I was like, that's perfect, because I'm not for all this pave stuff.
Right.
I'm not for pave. I'm sorry. That's just my personal taste.
You're a good son.
Yeah.
So, but I was like, but this is like, oh my God, it's the best of both worlds without having, you know, something that's probably is going to pop off and all that other stuff. It's just, so I love innovation at any level, not just it has to be, oh my God, okay, here's a hairspring that's blah, blah, blah. I love ones with, you know, the power reserve at a week or 2 weeks. Why can't we have a 1 year power reserve or a 1 month or two month power reserve?
They're working on it.
Yeah, and they are. And one day we'll get there.
Jack specifically is working.
And then people go, well, I can't mechanically wind my watch every 3 days. That's a problem. I can't have that. It's like, come on, guys. Like,
watch guys love nothing if not starting fights.
Yeah. And maybe with the E-Crown, because of what we have, it creates power reserves that are 20 times better. And then maybe the E-Crown dies from it, or the E-Crown evolves into something else because it's always wound. Right?
Like, right.
Great, so be it. Wonderful. But I still think you still got to set your watch and you got to change your time zone. So E-Crown's still going to be around to set your time zone, right? Which a longer power reserve won't do.
Right.
I mean, I think that it's easy for people to forget that one thing doesn't necessarily preclude another. One approach doesn't preclude another. But it's come close a couple of times. You know, quartz the advent of quartz watches was a huge crisis for mechanical watchmaking.
But it also opened up the market to so many more people buying it. It hurt some people who didn't innovate, who said, we're going to fight it, and other people who embraced it. Swatch, you know, you have to admire what they've done with, they didn't just take quartz, but they took quartz in a whole different direction, right? They didn't just say, oh, I'm just going to replace it and put it inside a traditionalist, watch body.
Yeah,
they
decide
to go incredible fashion.
But, you know, with hindsight, it's possible for us to look back at the quartz crisis and say, okay, that wasn't really an existential crisis. It created opportunities. But in 1973, 1978, it felt that way.
Absolutely. And that's what happened with just 3 or 4 years ago with smartwatches. You know, as soon as that, everybody's like, oh my God. I remember going to, SIHH the first time, and you guys go, oh, this feels so much better than last year, because everybody was in panic over what was going to happen to the industry with smartwatches coming.
Yeah. It was legitimately the sort of thing where, like, if you said the words Apple Watch in front of an executive from Switzerland, I mean, the room went dead quiet. You could hear a pin drop. People were really touchy about it. Not just out of fear, but also kind of resentment. Like, how could you possibly, you know, speak about this thing in the same breath as what we're doing? And it took a while, but I think the industry has started to adapt a little bit and maybe get over it a little bit.
But the way I think about it is that people or companies or industries or countries don't change unless there's a near-death experience. Right? Think about it. You sit there and you eat, drink, whatever it is. You don't exercise all of a sudden. And you're like, the doctor says, hey, you need to get healthy. Yeah, it's never going to happen to me. Then you get that heart attack. And you're like, oh, shit. I'm going to have to clean up my life, right? And some people, they make lifelong changes. Some people, six weeks or 6 months, they try to change. But any kind of organism usually will not make major changes unless there's a near-death experience. Quartz, smartwatches, and it breathes new life and new direction and makes a stagnant market or person or whatever evolve.
So you think we were primed to maybe enter like a new golden age or a new period of increased creativity because of the kind of like threat, again, in quotes, from smartwatches?
Exactly. When you have more constraints and more competition, it helps to focus. And you go, what are we really doing here? And you get the real innovation coming out, right? And saying, okay, we're going to embrace it and we're going to show them we can innovate too. Watch us, right? That's what the human spirit's all about. And so this is only healthy, right? And if they don't want to embrace it, or anybody in the industry doesn't want to embrace it, fine, but you're going to become the dodo bird. Like, you know, sooner or later.
Yeah.
So you have to embrace it. You know, I remember my friend, Jean-Claude Beaver, right? What was he saying pre-smartwatch? Never, never, never. What did it do? He got incredibly focused on smartwatches. And what is he? The best luxury smartwatch in the market from Tag, right?
Yeah.
He was saying, no. And then one day he listened and he looked and looked real hard, got challenged. And then he said, okay, I'm going to go full force into it. And they're successful because of it,
mm-hmm.
right? In that space. Is it long-term successful? I don't know. But for this moment in time, he changed his opinion, had his near-death, you know, his near-death experience, changed his opinion, and then capitalized on it. That's what I hope more brands and more designers in this business do, to take that and use it as a sense of optimism and hope that they can make something that's even better than what they have been for the last decade or more.
Yeah, purely from a practical standpoint, he actually talked to us very candidly at Bottle World about some of the challenges that, you know, you produce 20,000 smartwatches per year. That is not an interesting order to a chip manufacturer.
Sure. Sure. Okay, fine. So be it. Maybe he's going to find a way to bring that technology to more people to do 200,000 watches or what have you. So look, at the end of the day, it's making people think differently. It's making on both the mechanical or non-mechanical side of the watch side. And who knows what the industry is going to look like in 10 years. But I think it's a good sign of evolution, so that it's a healthy organism that is continuing to evolve.
And now a look at this week's sponsor. Bronze watches have become something of a trend lately, but with the Black Bay Bronze, Tudor is looking to its rich history of building watches for some of the world's largest navies, not simply following a fad. The robust bronze case nods to naval engineering and shipbuilding, and is made of a special alloy that will take on a beautiful patina over time, making each watch unique and intimately connected to the person wearing it. Inside, of course, you've got an in-house Tudor movement, the Caliber MT5601. It has a silicon balance spring, a 70-hour power reserve, and a cost chronometer certification, too. Visit your local authorized retailer to see this watch in the metal, or TudorWatch.com to learn more. Let's get back to the show.
It's abundantly clear that you're in the deep end here. You're like, you are seriously thinking about these things. But I wonder, where did this all start for you? Like, how did you get into watches in the first place?
So, it's a great question. So the first thing that happened for me was I got my first watch in the 90s.
Okay.
It was a Tag. I didn't know what I was doing, but I was like, oh, I should buy one. You know, this is now, today, they have, you know, there was no mobile phones. I'd be like, I don't need that. But I was like, hey, I'm growing up. I'm getting older. I should buy one.
Yeah.
And then right after that, my grandfather gave me his watches because his time was almost coming.
Okay.
Right. And he was, and they were nothing special, but he had worn those watches for years. Right. And I was like, oh, there's something here. And so that tipped me off. And then the next thing happened was I was at CES or Comdex one year.
Okay.
And I went by, I was in the Bellagio, I think it was. It was in 98 or 99. I think Bellagio was just open. And I passed by some watch retailer and I looked in. It was the first time I saw a Panera Luminor.
Okay.
And I was like, what is that? I went, I gotta have that.
And now, what year was this again, approximately?
It was 98 or 99.
Yeah, so that was very early days for modern Panerai.
Very early days. You know, because you couldn't find them. There was no advertising. It was just like there was a couple of shops that had them. I was like, what is that? I gotta have, I've never seen it. I gotta have that. And it just, and then from that, those three events, I started, that flywheel started spinning and my curiosity started going. And then after that, when I was at Apple with the iPod and subsequently, a lot of the manufacturing techniques to make modern day watches were being researched by Apple to understand how you make really tight mechanical systems, small, very highly toleranced things, and going through and understanding what equipment they use, what materials they use, all that stuff. And that, again, opened my eyes. I'm like, oh my God, there is incredible craftsmanship here. Stuff that it's like the pinnacle of mechanical engineering and manufacturing, you know, before nanofabrication happened, right? And that stuff when it was lithography based and more silicon-like.
So in those days at Apple, were you kind of the odd man out being interested in these things, or was there like a little community of you who were watching?
Oh no, there was a little community of us who had it. And it was Johnny, myself, a few of people on Johnny's team, a few people on the mechanical engineering team for the iPod and the iPhone, where we were all just like, you know, ogling over these things, going, "How do they do that? How do they do that?" And then there were trips to go to some of the manufacturing sites to learn, like, what, you know, just to understand what it is. Not that it was trying to make a watch at the time,
right,
but just to appreciate and see if we could translate and move some of those manufacturing techniques and design techniques to what we did to make a more highly precisioned mechanical electronic device.
And was this even pre-iPhone days?
Yeah, this was pre-iPhone days.
Okay.
Right? Because it was all about, you know, we had to... Apple before iPod was about bigger computers, laptops and stuff like that. When iPod came, it was all about every single millimeter and sub-millimeter and packing it down, length, width, height, volume, you know, weight balance, feel in the pocket, feel in the hand, all that stuff. So there was a lot of similarities. And what we were trying to do is, okay, what's the best techniques to make the board smaller, the packaging smaller, but what can we get a better finish outside case, you know, to, like I said, with different materials and different finishes and making sure it's scratch-proof in certain places and you could drop it and it's okay. And so all of that stuff we're like, well, what are high-end things that are treated as such that you wear every day?
That's a fascinating intersection between watchmaking and what you guys were doing at Apple, you know, because in both domains you have this intersection of aesthetics and engineering, and the one kind of supports the other. You know, what you can do in terms of aesthetics is very, very dependent on what you can do from an engineering standpoint.
No, absolutely. And you have to combine the two to make sure they look good, just like we talked about in the RD2 about, what is the right proportions? Do you really want to make it that slim? Because if you make it too slim, it'll fall out of your pocket or it won't feel good in the hand or whatever. So you have to, maybe you make it a little thicker, but then you reduce the width or reduce the length in some different way. So all of those things, you know, were part of our psyche and thinking about it at the time to make a holistic design experience.
So when you look at traditional watchmaking, like, you know, traditional watchmaking is very, very bound by traditional practices and traditional perspectives. Like, you know, one of the things that I don't think anyone has ever done in the watch industry is kind of systematically look at, you know, what's the ideal shape for a watch? What's the ideal size? What size should things be? Do you think that the watch industry would benefit in some sense from a more, like taking a step back from traditional practices and looking at some of these basic issues more systematically?
Yeah, absolutely. Not just because of the smartwatch revolution, but they should be doing that all the time. And that's why when you saw something like the Apple Watch come out and you say, wow, look at these quick change straps. And you're like, right, oh my God, why hasn't this ever come out in the traditional watch business? And you're like, now I can accessorize this thing. This is amazing. And it's easy to use and it's so intuitive and like it's fun. And you're like, I'm going to buy lots of bands to make it easy.
Fun.
Like to use a freaking, you know, pry bar on springs. It's like, come on. And then I'm going to scratch something.
Right.
And then
it's
like, or I got a, you know, a little screw that I'm going to hurt the, you know, the threads. Or it's like, no, guys.
And we still have strap changing technology that's basically stayed the same since about 1935.
Right. Why not innovate on something that seems like so logical and simple to do?
Yeah.
So again, you have to go and challenge all of your tradition and go back and see if there's something better. And there's a lot of traditional things in the Apple Watch that were rethought that can be brought back into traditional, you know, mechanical watches in a way. And right. and likewise, they're going to learn more. You know, it was one way, which was the watch thing influenced the Apple products, which then influenced the Apple Watch, which is now influencing the watches again. And right. it's this synergy that is going to continue if both sides stay healthy and they're going to push each other in new ways that and new experiences we've never seen before. And that's what's fascinating and fun.
So going back to your watch collection for just a bit. You did an episode of Talking Watches, and so our readers, we'll link that up in the show notes, so anybody who hasn't seen that can take a look. But since then, how has your watch collecting changed and evolved? And have there been any kind of new areas of collecting you've gotten interested in, anything you loved that you've kind of like gotten off of?
I stopped collecting.
You're kidding.
No.
Tony's trying to give us a heart attack.
And that's the show.
And that's the goodbye. No, absolutely. No, it's expanded and it's grown because I've appreciated other brands. I've appreciated other technology, other watches and stuff like that. But I think the fundamentals still apply. Except that I have grown more through you, the publication, you, Stephen, you, Jack, you, Ben, and Uri, all you guys, about looking at some of the older watches and collecting those. I have been collecting more of those.
Yeah.
Right? So I went back to go collect some of the very first automatic watches from Patek and others because you guys taught me about those. I was like, okay, yes, those are ones I would definitely buy because they are
really fascinating. People tried out some weird stuff in those, you know, early days.
Absolutely. And they're like, that's cool. You know, and I want to celebrate that in my collection, which is here's people who push the edges and they try to do it in an intelligent fashion, even though it may not have caught on. I think it's worthy of the collection in my collection saying, here's people who tried and I thought it was worthwhile. I thought it was a worthwhile innovation and not everyone picked it up, yeah. But hey, I thought it was cool.
I mean, I know one watch we both love and I think Jack is probably a fan as well as the 2526. I mean, that to me is a watch that does everything you were talking about and succeeds from a design perspective.
Exactly. And yeah. so when you look at that, you have to just marvel and say, you got to hand it to them and you got to put yourself back in time then. Now it looks, oh yeah, of course. But back then, people were arguing over it, right? Just like we're arguing it now.
Right.
And
right.
you're like, they made a bold step. And you say, okay, with that bold step, I appreciate it. We just have to remember the context of when these technologies come to light and the environment that started. You have to remember, like the iPod, Apple wasn't a successful company then. It had to take incredible risk to do something well outside of its normal product line, to do something that everyone like, are you crazy? You're going to go up against Sony, you're going to do all this stuff. But it took guts. And I like find those things back in history that took guts, right?
Yeah.
Along the way and put those as part of the collection.
And serendipity, luck to a certain degree. I mean, the technology has to mature at the right time. The world, the environment around the technology has to be receptive. The people around the technology, you know, the people out in the market.
Absolutely. The biggest thing, and this goes for any kind of technology, is society ready to adopt it? Not everybody, but at least enough of the right people to adopt it. Not just early adopters from a novelty perspective, but the next set of people after that, the pragmatists who go, you technology pragmatists who go, yeah, that seems interesting. You can't just go, you know, there's a company called General Magic that I work for in the early 90s.
Which there's an amazing documentary about, which Tony was kind enough to invite me to the premiere of. So we'll link that up in the show notes
also. Great.
It's an incredible, incredible film.
Right, but it was the iPhone 15 years. The story of the iPhone 15 years too soon.
It's crazy.
It had all the same, a lot of the similar things with older technology, but society wasn't ready for it. Right? It was just the right thing at the wrong time. So to your point, Jack, you're absolutely right. You got to make sure the stars align. And that's not just the industry analyst saying it's the right thing that the companies does, right? It's also society that says it's the right thing, right? And you can't hold back society, right? They're going to have their own views and everything
else. If you're running a multi-billion dollar company, that's actually kind of unsettling. I mean, the degree to which it's something that you can create markets to a certain degree. But on another level, what goes on, you know, socially and in terms of what people are ready for functionally and aesthetically, that's completely out of your hands.
It's completely. Now, you can, as you said, if it's too far away, but if you have the right marketing and you can't be of the moment of what everybody's thinking of, you have to be just ahead, not too far ahead, And not too current, just enough to get those people who are curious, intelligent, knowledgeable about the past, and always looking for some kind of new thing to get them engaged. And those are your customers, those are your influencers, those are your passionate people who will then be your best marketers, who will tell everybody about it to go off and buy it. Because look at this, just like we're doing right now, like about the RD2 or whatever.
Right, completely.
You gotta go look at this. This is the thing, right? And it goes for any really smart company. They have to get all that stuff aligned and then communicate it in the proper way.
Yeah, I mean, this is something you've been particularly savvy at, I would say, is that combination between...
I had a lot of failure. I've learned along the way.
That's fair.
I'm not young like you.
Hey, you know, that's fair. You've had a lot of success.
You should see my back.
Yeah?
You know, with the scars over here, so...
you know, the products that I think a lot of people know you for are incredibly well designed, and they're marketed in a way that makes sense with their design, and their design makes sense with the way they're marketed. Those two things are kind of cohesive and built together. How do you use that perspective to then kind of look at other things, whether it's watches or other kind of industries you're watching, and kind of use that as a lens?
That's a great question. First, you know, all of these things that I have worked on has been with a team. So I want to be very clear. Lots of people, lots of smart people, and I got to be a, you know, at the forefront of that with these people and these incredible smart teams for many years. Secondly, Steve Jobs had a mantra. He said, the best marketing just tells the truth. The best marketing tells the truth. You can have lifestyle marketing. You can have all this other stuff. But if you really talk to and envision someone's life or your own life, hopefully, and you paint the picture of what was before and what it would be like after this innovation of whatever it is, and you speak the truth, and then when they get it in their hands and you've under-promised and over-delivered, you've won that customer for, you know, the next product that you have and the next product. And that's why Apple is the way it is. And other companies are like that. You know, we all sit there with bated breath going, what is the next thing? That's why you guys have rumors and you guys do what you do, right? You keep everybody stoked with, this is coming, that's coming, oh my God. Because you understand the brands. They've built up some kind of trust over time with a certain set of customers, and you expect it from them. And if they deliver it every time, sooner or later you just go, I want whatever they've got. I don't have to learn too much about it. I just know they're going to deliver. So give me that next thing, right? And it is about not perfuming a pig. It's not about some highfalutin marketing or some brand ambassador, right? It's about speaking the truth about what it is and how it affects your life. And that is, if you can come up with that marketing, you know, marketing statements, right? The marketing statements when you're designing the product, because then you know it's easy to make those marketing statements. You're not doing it at the end and going, why does this matter? You're doing it just like you do with the mechanicals of the watch and the design of the watch and making it a little bit better to make it look, you know, look appropriate to your design aesthetic. You're also doing the marketing at the exact same time. Mm-hmm. Because it's not marketing applied. It comes out of the design. The marketing comes right out of the design. Because you already know what key factors and critical things that you are trying to accomplish with the design. So it's an incredible design brief. It's not marketing. It's the design brief of what you're trying to achieve. Once you think you've achieved, you go back to your design brief and say, oh my God, the two are in concert with each other. Ship it. And you don't have this whole marketing thing. Now there's all kinds of marketing implementation, like what's the imagery and all the other stuff.
Right.
But the key messages of why this thing should exist is intrinsic in the design.
So what is the watch industry supposed to do in a situation where, you know, product development cycle for a new watch is 5 years on average.
I can't understand that. That is crazy.
And we're in a yearly we're in a yearly product development cycle now, which is not a natural one historically,
right,
for mechanical watchmaking. And ever, and the pressure has become even greater. You know, ever since quartz, you know, you have to come out with something that makes it. You must make a big splash every single year on the dot when the trade show comes along,
right.
And it's got to be amazing, and it's got to be revolutionary, and it's got. And you know, the product does not necessarily support that, but a lot of companies feel obliged to try and do that anyway.
Well, and people see through that. So look, at the end of the day, welcome to the world of technology. It's just saying you need to get faster, better, cheaper, more intuitive. That's just what happens in all industries. You know, how long does it take to design a car? We've now shaved that down and gotten faster. Everything gets faster, more intelligent. If the watch industry wants to stay with five-year cycles, fine, but it's going to die because of it. It needs to get faster, yeah. But not faster for faster sake. Get better at doing it. What are the tools, the technologies? You have to have a separate R&D track from your product track. All technology companies do it. You have an R&D team who's going off and prototyping and doing all this stuff behind the scenes going, oh, we got this mechanism. Oh, we have this material. Oh, we have this finish. Oh, we have this manufacturing capability. Da, 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 da. And then they say, now we have a new watch for next year. Which of these cool components that we have being built over here can we take and apply to this specific design brief for this specific customer, for this truth that we want to speak, right? And that informs the R&D roadmap, which then continues to make novel new kinds of innovations, which then feeds back into the process. So if it takes 5 years to design a watch, it shouldn't take 5 years to design a watch. It should be 1 year to 18 months, no more than 2 years to bring out something new. But it might take 3 years to design all the technology and manufacturing and all this stuff behind that thing,
right,
to bring in. So if anyone starts and said, I'm going to make a watch and it's going to take 5 years to do, that's not the right way to think of it. You got to break it down. Remember, the iPhone, we threw away two designs before we shipped one, right? Because we tried over and over and to get it right. And I hope watch companies are doing the same thing, not just making stuff to get it out the door, but trying and pushing the edge really, really hard. And then maybe they have to throw it away, but they've tried and they learned from it, but continue on to make the next thing, to figure out what was wrong with it, make the right one, and then ship it. So sometimes it's better not to say anything every year and try, because you lose your brand cachet. You lose that brand trust if you're speaking non-truths.
If you're shouting all the time.
If you're always shouting without a reason for people to really listen.
Yeah.
You just become noise, and there's not enough signal. You got to have high signal, low noise, to use a electronic vernacular.
Yeah, that's perfect. You know, one thing I wanted to talk about that we didn't touch on is, you know, you've talked a lot in the past about device addiction, and about the sense that these electronic devices are taking over our lives.
Or watch collecting.
And watch collecting, right. Which is a conversation we had earlier today in the office. Do you see mechanical watches in any way as an antidote to that, as a thing that you can kind of replace a potential screen with or enjoy in a way that's distinct and different from the way we use and enjoy our screens?
So for me, you know, over the past decade now, I have grown more and more cognizant of where and when I want screens and why I want screens, right? When it's always strapped to your wrist, you don't have a lot of choice.
Yeah.
Right? And so, not saying that that's bad. Some people need it. Maybe they might need it for work or exercise or whatever else. So some people need that. You know, I've chosen specifically not to put one on because I don't want something bothering me all the time. So now with something like all the new, you know, data collecting, data transparency, and control that you have with these new operating systems from Apple with screen time and Google has coming and that kind of stuff. If I can set it so the watch is just a watch, and under certain circumstances, maybe I get a notification or I get something else when I have a screen attached, so it's primarily what I want it to be, but only in certain instances do I get it and it's easy to do, maybe I'll start wearing a display on my wrist.
Mm.
But I don't want one there just yet another, you know, buzzer or yet another thing flashing at me if I can't control it and adapt it to the way I want to live my life, right? And so the technology business has heard a lot of people talking about not just addiction, but overuse or, you know, trending to overuse. And they are now, you know, creating tools and technologies to help with that so you can better fit this into your life the way you want to. And not just the way all of these different apps want to just suck up all your attention, right?
Right.
And that is a healthy thing and a reason for more people to buy more devices.
Right.
Right? Because I know for my kids, I'm like, I can't buy them all these devices because it's too hard to control. Like an iPhone, an iPad, an Apple TV, a computer. I can't control all this. And I have to sit there and be the policeman. So. Right.
Which I'm sure is super fun, having to be the device policeman for kids.
Between me and my wife, yeah. It causes a lot of stress in your life, right? In your family, which it shouldn't be there because the kids want what the kids want. And you're like, you have to say no even more than you have to, right? Already. So when I think about it, when you can have this kind of control, you're like, oh, sure, I'll buy you more devices. And their business grows because of it. Because I know I can control it and I know I can give it to them or myself to fit into the lifestyle I want to lead because I can then tune it and adapt it.
Yeah, I think, you know, some congratulations are in order. We're recording this the day after France won the World Cup, and you are a current Parisian.
Allez les bleus!
So, you know, you had a lot of success in California, in the Valley, and you then left and moved to Paris, and you're a watch guy, and you're like, you're a little bit swimming against the grain there. Do you think that...
In Paris?
No. By leaving Silicon Valley for Paris. Is there something about leaving the Valley that's kind of like changed your thinking or you think gives you some different perspective on the world?
So, you know, I got bit by the travel bug really when the first time I left North America when I was 21 or 22 at General Magic, which you talk about. And I went to the first place I went was with General Magic to Tokyo.
Oosh. That's a hell of a first trip.
That was the first trip, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, Toto, we're not in Kansas anymore, right? I was like, and then I got bit. And I was like, all of these different things and inspirations you can get from going all around the world to learn from different people at different times about different things, about how their religion or their culture has influenced the decisions they've made or the technology they use or how they've changed. And so when you look at, you know, changing where you live, right? If I wouldn't have taken a risk to move from Detroit to Silicon Valley, you know, 26, well now almost 30 years ago, I would have never been able to do what I did. And if I didn't embrace traveling, I wouldn't have been in Paris now. The amount of inspiration you get, if you were curious, you're not like everywhere you go, you're like, well, why don't they have a McDonald's? And why don't they have, it's like, come on. Like you gotta put yourself in their shoes and start to learn about that. You can actually grow as an individual. And I found that incredibly rewarding. And I wanted to give that to my kids and to my family as an experience to help them understand that the world's a big place. I was in Silicon Valley 26 years at the time we moved. You know, big fish in a big pond, life is wonderful. Why not just stay? Where there's no stress, there you're not gonna grow.
Yeah.
And so I learned this through when, you know, 10 years prior when we did our first trip around the world after Apple with my family. I got to go to different houses, live in different houses, different cities around the world with my family to kind of soak these things up, to kind of clear my brain and get from the Apple experience, which is amazing, but to try to get a new perspective. And I got so much input and inspiration from all those things, especially in Paris, that it caused me to write the Nest business plan, to see the problem that Nest was trying to fix, and to create the Nest business plan in Paris. And it was so compelling that I had to go back to Silicon Valley to build it, right? And if I didn't do that trip, if I didn't have that stress on the system, if I was always just comfortable with my other surroundings, that company wouldn't have ever existed, right? And that idea never would have came to light. And so I don't see this as the move to Paris to be something that was, you know, something that was getting away from anything. I think we made Silicon Valley better in a way, or changed the world in a way, because we went out, found something, went back to build it. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm trying to take that same thing and go around the world to find all these great entrepreneurs, to find all these other things, because Silicon Valley is not the only place. As we know, we can see China developing like crazy. Try to find these interesting people who are also curious, who are doing great things, getting out of that same environment and seeing if we can inject other interesting ideas into the world with multiple entrepreneurs, not just one startup. So you may think it's going against the tide of everyone running there, but I think that you need to evolve. And the whole world is evolving now with technology, not just Silicon Valley's driving it. It's still a driver, but is not the driver by a wide margin any longer. And we're seeing the rise of everyone now, and I want to help that. And I'm as curious as ever. And so Paris is about that, and Europe in general is about that.
Well, to wrap each show, we'd like to end with cultural recommendations. So, Tony, if I can put you on the spot, is there a book or a movie or something you've seen somewhere you've traveled recently that you want to recommend to everyone listening?
So I don't remember the author's name right now, but there's a book called In Praise of Shadows.
Okay.
The book is only about 70 pages. It was written in the 1930s in Japan.
Okay.
And it was all about the transition of Japanese traditional housewares and homes and lighting and everything when the westernization of all of that came to Japan. And it's through the eyes of this person about here's what life was like before and after this transition. Housewares, lighting, everything. And it is such an eye-opener and has a different way of perceiving the world in designs that I think it opened my eyes to so many things, and I had got so many ideas about it. So it's called In Praise of Shadows. You can get on Amazon. It's a very quick read. But for me, it was a bomb went off in my brain in the best way.
I will be ordering it as soon as I take my phone off airplane mode. Jack, how about you?
I've been reading a lot more novels lately, and I just finished a piece of amazing fiction by a Hungarian writer who coincidentally lived in Japan in Kyoto for many years. The book is called Seibo Down Below. Seibo is the Shinto goddess of the West. And the book is basically a series of vignettes of experiences of beauty that people have had in different times and places throughout history. And the goddess is sort of there as the background visitant to all of these experiences. So a sort of a spiritual manifestation of beauty that shows up anywhere from the Renaissance, up to the 20th century. And one of the chapters in the book is about a shrine in Ise, Japan, called the Ise Grand Shrine. It's the main Shinto shrine in Japan. And they have been tearing the entire shrine complex down and rebuilding it every 20 years for 800 years. So it's a really fascinating way of achieving continuity, you know, rather than trying to build, you know, a pyramid which will persist for 5,000 years because it's a giant pile of stone. You create this living organism.
I love it because that's awesome. What we do in it. Which what happens in nature with trees, you know,
right.
Life and death. I'd love it. Okay, yeah. I got it. And I can't wait to see this link.
Yeah,
I would tell you the author's name, but he's Hungarian. I cannot pronounce his last name.
Okay, all right. Just like Japanese for me.
I'm gonna go with a book this week too. There's a book called You Say to Brick. It's the biography of Louis Kahn, an architect who's work I really love, but who I knew absolutely nothing about, and I'm, you know, very close to finishing the book, about 50 pages away from the end. And he's a really conflicted, kind of difficult, sort of unpleasant-sounding person, which I was not aware of. But it's really fascinating that he had all of these troubles. His practice was, like, perpetually bankrupt and, like, leveraging themselves constantly to get new projects. But they
sounds like Tesla.
Yeah, right. And they just kept working through it and making these amazing things that have persisted and that have become sort of these iconic structures. And he worked all around the world and kind of brought this very American perspective on architecture to other places and always kind of inflected it with what he found there instead of just kind of imposing himself on other places, which I found really interesting. So it's a pretty easy read. You Say to Brick, the biography of Louis Kahn.
Cool. So. I got to check it out.
Well, cool. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Tony. It's always a pleasure to see you and to talk to you. And I think people are going to enjoy this.
Thanks, guys. It was wonderful to do this. This is a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to hearing the feedback and seeing the comments.
Thank you again to Tony and Jack for joining us. This week's episode was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen and recorded at Mirror Tone Studios in New York City. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference. Thank you, and see you next week.